Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
The new screensavers is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at QuickenLoans.com/NSS.
Using x-rays to find supernovas and black holes, not all pixels are created equal. And is that the sound of pancakes? Live from the Twit Eastside Studios in beautiful Petaluma, it's the new screensavers.
From Chandler, Arizona. Just for that, you get a cupcake. Come take your cupcake. We have... Hi, Megan Maroney.
Oh, hi.
Welcome to the Screensavers, the new Screensavers. Would you like to get one for Emily, too?
Yes. She has to sit through this whole show. She needs one, too.
Yeah, poor Emily should have a cupcake. Why are there cupcakes? It's
100.
Episode 100.
Our 100th birthday.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And it's the 47th time you've done this show.
47th and a half.
It just
feels
that
I don't know if I'm
going
to do the whole show. It depends on what you say.
We did not plan this look together. It's just summertime in Petaluma.
Yeah, these are our Easter clothes.
Easter bonnet. Mm-hmm. I have your bonnet.
Oh, my Easter bonnet?
Yeah, here's your Easter bonnet.
Oh, thank you.
This is appropriate because today you're going to be making pancakes.
I am?
With the pancake bot.
Pancake bot, pancake bot, pancake bot, pancake bot. I always have to say that.
Oh, is that... Now, we have a new game we're going to play. What's the pancake bot making today? That looks like mushroom from Mario.
I think it looks like an astronaut's helmet.
Could be. We have a Megan. You want to see the Megan?
Yes.
We made Megan.
Someone ate it already? Oh, look at that. I'm...
Wow. Wow.
My hair is not that curly, but I get it.
It's Megan-ish. Hey, it's a pancake for crying out
loud. Also, what's going on with my neck there?
It's the fully edible. Colleen Goldstein's been making those pancakes with a pancake bot. We're going to interview the creator, the inventor, Miguel Valenzuela, all the way from Norway via Skype. Oh. Also, astrophysicist Wallace Tucker will join us to talk about NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. This is so cool. Observing black holes and other things. It's one of the four big telescopes NASA has put up to observe different spectra of the visible sky and invisible sky, and we're going to find out what it's seen. Father Robert Ballasaire will show us in this day and age when we're trying to get more private how to use a Raspberry Pi to make your own Tor instance.
Oh.
Yeah. And Bill Wadman emailed me about a month ago. He's a great portrait photographer. You've seen his work. He's done all the geeks. He's done Gina Trapani. We'll show you some of his pictures. At Baratunde, he said, I would like to come by. I'm in town and take a picture of you. That look at these are some of the best. So he's going to show us the secrets of the great portrait photographers. There's Jonathan Colton, Charlie Rose, really some neat stuff.
I think they should add my pancake picture in
your there. Pancake picture. If you had a better headshot, is that Andy Anako behind the comic? That's awesome. Anyway, Bill Wadman's here. We're going to talk about portrait photography. Jason Howell is going to give us a review of the new YouTube TV on Android, how that works, and the mailbag. But first, the news of the day. And the news of the day, just completely coincidentally, has nothing to do with the fact that I'm starving right now, is about McDonald's and Burger King.
Right. We have to give them equal airtime.
Equal time.
Right? So our show is sponsored by neither.
I saw somebody yesterday say that Burger King should be prosecuted for its ad. You know the ad I'm talking about? Do we have that video? So play the video of the guy, because it doesn't
work. Watching a 15-second Burger King ad, which is unfortunately not enough time to explain all the fresh ingredients in the Whopper sandwich. But I got an idea. Okay. What is the Whopper burger?
And The director of marketing at Burger King coincidentally had gone into the Wikipedia page and modified it so that the first sentence described a Whopper in delicious detail. And it worked.
For a while.
Then Google got involved.
Right. Well, first thing, people got really angry. You would not believe how angry people get when you mess with their home voice assistants. And it's because you're sort of reaching into their living room and messing with stuff, right?
We do it all the time by accident.
By accident. But we don't do it so much anymore because we get a lot of angry emails.
Yeah, in fact, I have a new, you know, we sent the memo out. When you talk about Amazon's voice assistant, we say Amazon Echo, not the A word. With Siri, we've been calling her Shlomo. I don't know how that... The problem with that is nobody knows what the hell you're saying.
You can say Siri all you want. She will never answer.
You don't say the hey beforehand. And she doesn't answer anyway. She's a, you know. And then Cortana. We can't say, you know, Cortana. And then, but the one that he used, the OK, you know who, triggers not just the Google phones, but also those Google Home devices. So it blares through the house.
And your phone. I heard someone's phone go off just now.
Really?
I heard it.
Well, that's the thing. It might go blink, but it won't. Google turned off the response to it, right? But they have to do that onesie-twosie.
Well, what they did, first of all, was, you know, they updated the Wikipedia page. People don't like it when heads of marketing update Wikipedia. So then people went in to change the ingredients.
They said it was made of toenail clippings.
Cyanide.
See,
it may
Burger
very
King
well be.
Really wasn't thinking when they came up with this thing. Google pulls, for its knowledge graph, pulls the Wikipedia page and reads the first sentence. If you ask it, you know, who is Leo Laporte, it'll read the first sentence of my... No, don't you do that. I know what you're thinking. It reads the first sentence of my Wikipedia entry, which now says Leo Laporte is a porn star from the early 80s. So that was one way people responded. But
you took
really
your hat off. I guess I should take mine off, too.
Well, I didn't want to wear an Easter bonnet all day. I'll put it back on the side.
So then, but they changed it slightly for late night, because I guess it was on Jimmy Fallon's show, slightly different. Google changed it, and then they changed it back at night, and they had one last shot at it, and now Google doesn't respond anymore.
You think this is the beginning of like more people doing this? People were so upset. Look, Burger King got the attention they wanted.
Yes, we're still talking about it.
And it does make me want a delicious Whopper with cheese right about now. But that's because I'm starving. But I think in the long run, it's probably not good for brands to do this. You get some viral attention, but in the long run, not good. How about the other fast food story? 8-year-old kid, his little sister says, I want a hamburger. Gets in the car with his sister, drives a mile and a half to McDonald's, observes all traffic laws, makes several turns, doesn't hit anything. Pulls up, doesn't even go inside. They pull up to the drive-in,
smart,
the drive-thru, and they get a burger. The drive-thru people said, we thought it was a joke, like the parents must be in the back seat. There's no, but no, he drove there. And what did you say? It was a relative that's recognized him?
I think inside. I think many people called the police because they saw it. It was a small town in Ohio, East Palestine or something. And people were calling the police because they saw. And so, yeah, by the time they were in the parking lot, finally getting to enjoy their delicious cheeseburgers, the police surrounded them. That's the sad part. And he started crying and then asked how he learned to drive. And he said, YouTube. Learned how to drive on YouTube.
Wow.
Why watching YouTube videos.
So I immediately went to YouTube because I'd like to learn how to drive, too. And the very first, if you search for YouTube driving lessons, the very first one you find, well, I don't know if it's really the way he should learn how to drive. It's from the UK, and you learn how to drive on the left.
Oh.
So we're just lucky he didn't see that one first.
Right? Well, you know, I do not know how to drive a stick shift, and I posted on Facebook asking about learning how to drive a stick shift, and many people said, learn on YouTube. I learned on YouTube.
Really?
I didn't learn on YouTube because I decided I just didn't want to know that.
But you could have?
You could have, probably.
I think it's remarkable. I mean, YouTube's a great place to learn. The kid, by the way, also knows how to adjust the seat perfectly. Yeah.
He stopped at lights. He only had to make right turns, which, of course, that makes sense.
That's
if he had
easier
to make a left turn, that would be harder. You know, there's amazing. My children learn amazing things on YouTube. Lately, they've been watching plastic surgery videos. So I'm hoping that they will.
They may have a future.
Yeah, so if you need anything, a little lift or tuck
that
or anything, just call my 12-year-old.
That is just wild. What kids today will learn.
Yeah.
All right, we've got the Pancake Bot here. We're going to talk to its creator in just a little bit. Colleen Goldstein is working. One of our producers is working it. Are you an expert pancake botter?
Almost.
Wow. Apparently, early on, there were some issues with viscosity.
Oh, yeah.
Jerry said that we had the pancake batter too thin, and so we made it a little bit thicker. And then Miguel's going to give us some more tips in a little bit. What is she making? Oh, see, that's the right consistency right there. And then you put the batter in the patented Pancake Bot squirter, and then and you're making look at this. This is so awesome. What did you make? Let's see the pancake. Oh, I like that. Literally.
How do you know it's a thumbs up? It might be the wrong angle. Could be thumbs
down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Depend on how you arrange it on the plate.
I've always wanted. Now I really want one of those. That is so awesome.
The smell alone is delicious.
So we're going to make pancakes. For nobody's here, so I don't know why, but for some reason we're going to continue to make pancakes throughout the show. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a big plate of weird-looking pancakes at the end of the show. But if you hear in the background, it's not noisy, but it sounds a little bit like an inkjet. Like a
3D printer.
Yeah. Going, if you hear that, that's what's going on. We'll talk to the inventor in just a little bit. Also, coming up next, we're going to go out into deep space. Now, everybody knows about the Hubble telescope. Right after Hubble, there was another telescope called Chandra. Hubble looks at the visible spectrum, stuff you and I can see. Chandra looks at X-rays. And Chandra is kind of interesting because while the Hubble is in orbit 300 miles around the Earth, the Chandra is in an elliptical orbit that goes many tens of thousands of miles away from the Earth and then comes back, delivers its data, and then goes back out again. It's kind of neat. We go into space with the Chandra Telescope, and astrophysicist Wallace Tucker from the Smithsonian's Chandra X-ray Observatory in just a bit. But first, I want to tell you about our sponsor, and it's kind of timely, Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage. This is the creation of the great folks at Quicken Loans. If it's time to buy a house or refi a house, you want to go to a lender, A, that you trust, but you also want to go to a lender that's going to give you control. And if you're a geek like me, you want to do that all online. You don't want to get up, go out of the house. And this is the beauty of Rocket Mortgage. You can do it all online. QuickenLoans.com/NSS. With your phone, with your iPad, you can even do it at an open house. All the paperwork they need, check statements and pay stubs you can submit with a push of a button. There's sliders to adjust the rate on your loan and to adjust the term of your loan. And then when you've got it just right, you press Approve Me. And within minutes, not months, not weeks, not years, not days, within minutes, you'll get approved for a loan that's just right for you. QuickenLoans.com/NSS, the best lender in the country, and they've made a product just for us geeks. Equal housing lender, of course. Licensed in all 50 states, you bet. And MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Check it out, QuickenLoans.com/NSS for Rocket Mortgage. Quicken Loans. We've made our way over, not quite the distance that Chandra went, but we made our way over across the studio to talk to Wallace Tucker. He's an astrophysicist and the author of a new book from the Smithsonian Books all about Chandra's cosmos. Wallace, welcome to the new screen center.
Thank you. Glad to
be
here.
I got a little confused because I didn't realize this. We all know Hubble. That's the best-known mm-hmm. space telescope. What I didn't realize is that when NASA launched Hubble, they were working on a total of four space telescopes.
That's correct.
Right? Yeah. So what was the difference between Hubble and Chandra?
Hubble is sensitive to visible or optical wavelengths, and so that means it's sensitive to stars, which typically have a temperature of 10,000 degrees to 20,000 degrees.
It's not an accident. It makes sense that we would be able to see
no accident
star.
At all. That's right.
Right. No. Otherwise, we'd go walk around the Earth without bumping
That's
into
right.
things. Yeah.
And Chandra is sensitive to gas that's got temperatures of millions of degrees.
Oh, interesting.
And so it's a big difference in that respect. And when they tried to launch the first X-ray telescope, there's a lot of skepticism. You're not going to see anything.
Right.
Well, what they found out is that most of the matter, the normal matter in the universe, is hot.
Right.
It's at millions of degrees. So Chandra and other X-ray telescopes have uncovered where most of the matter is. And, of course, that I'm saying normal matter because that gets us into the question of dark matter, which we don't, it's definitely not normal, but there's more of that than anything else. So
here's our Milky Way. And actually, these are some beautiful images. This is the center of the Milky Way. It's almost 500 light years across here that we're looking at.
The center is almost 500 light years, and the Milky Way is, of course.
So you're seeing some. What do we learn from these X-ray images that we didn't learn from visible light?
As I said before, you're seeing the hot face of the universe with Chandra, and some of the X-ray photographs, you'll see a shockwave that's going millions of miles an hour, and it produces this hot gas. It's simply not visible with the optical telescope.
Is that the result of a nova or
a supernova?
Supernova,
an exploding star, And turns out that not only do stars explode, galaxies, the black holes in the center of them can produce explosions which go over thousands and even millions of light years and produce, again, hot gas that you can only see with a telescope like Chandra.
So has Chandra found some black holes?
It's found more black holes than any other telescope in history. There was one project which was fascinating. You may be familiar with the Hubble Deep Field, where they just stared at one place for a long time. Well, they did the same thing with Chandra. They picked a field where, as far as they knew, there was nothing. They said, we're just going to stare at that field for weeks and months. And they found thousands of black holes out there.
You don't see a black hole because there's no light emerging from it. What do you see if you're looking at a black hole?
You see, you detect them because matter is falling into the black hole.
You
and as the matter falls in, think of swirling down the drain of a bathtub. As it swirls around, it goes faster and faster, and the friction gets so great that it heats this material to millions of degrees and it gives off X-rays.
So it's like Wizard of Oz. You see like houses going down there and stuff.
Yeah, same thing.
There's some amazing images of black holes in here, including something called a green black hole. I don't know why it would be green. These are not, in order for us to see these pictures, they have to be adjusted, to the lights.
They come in as digital information, and then they transform that into an image, because there's position and energy characteristic of each bit that comes in, so they can reconstruct it to an image.
Is there something they're hoping to see from that they haven't found yet that they're aiming to see?
Yeah, I divide the book into the big, the bad, and the beautiful, and in each case there's something that they really want to find. Like, the big is the largest objects in the universe, and they would like to see just how large they are. There's galaxy clusters of thousands of galaxies, each one with trillions of stars. They'd like to know where these end. They haven't really seen the edge of those. And then they really haven't been able to detect or understand what the dark matter is. They'd like to know what that is. That's one of the major emphasis and targets of Chandra, is to find that. Mm-hmm. Then they'd also like to understand the black holes. And you referred to green black holes. We call them green black holes because they recycle matter. The matter comes into the black hole, and this was a discovery that Chandra played a very important role in. They thought before the matter falls through a black hole, all of it's going to go in. Well, it turned out that not all of it goes in. It's like if you notice that when the matter swirls into the water goes into the drain, some of it bubbles. Mm-hmm. It can't get in fast enough, and that's what happens with black holes. It's really twisting magnetic fields and shooting jets of particles at near the speed of light back out into the galaxy. Maybe 50, maybe 70 or 80% of the matter gets recycled, and then it helps to form new stars and things like that.
There's also an infrared telescope.
Spitzer. Yeah, telescope.
And that's at the other end of the spectrum.
That would be beyond Hubble in terms of its infrared, so it measures what we normally call heat radiation. It's not heat radiation, it's radiation from warm bodies.
Right.
So it's sensitive to that. We're radiating infrared radiation now. And that's what Spitzer is good at, is finding the warm dust around stars. It's where it's been especially productive.
So how long, Chandra's still going. You were telling me, and it has an unusual orbit. The Hubble's just 300 miles above the Earth, just kind of going around and around. It's a circular orbit, but not Chandra.
Chandra has an elliptical orbit, and this is by design, because once Hubble was up there, they said it really costs a lot to service Hubble. we're not going to service Chandra.
Well, I was going to ask you, because Hubble, we've actually sent rockets up to service it.
It's a good thing they could service it, actually. Right. And yes, they said, well, this was good. We did a great job with Hubble, and it's a wonderful telescope, but we're not going to do it again with Chandra. We're going to put it up in an orbit where you'll never be able to service it.
So that was a selling point? Is that, you can't,
well,
you
yeah, and they said, and we protested, but then got to thinking about it. It's not such a bad idea, because if you get up 6,000 miles above Earth, there's a lot less junk there. It takes a long time, 55, 60 days to make an orbit. You're out of the interference of the shadow. The telescope itself is not getting cool and hot. So it turns out to be a very benign orbit, and it leads for high productivity because you can observe almost all the time. You're not in the shadow of the Earth.
So it goes 60,000 miles away from Earth.
Yeah, maybe 85,000.
Really. And then comes back and comes close to Earth.
6,000 miles. Never close enough to be serviced.
Right, close enough to send data back.
It sends data back to one of three receiving stations on Earth. And so depending on conditions, it'll download the data to a place in the Pacific or a place in Spain or a place here at Goddard Space Flight Center in the U.S.
Must be wonderful for astronomers to be able to observe phenomenon that they've theorized or thought about, but actually see it, things like the merging white dwarfs and things like that, and actually see the results of those in action.
Yeah, that is fantastic, that some things that people had thought of, they thought, well, maybe we'll see this and maybe we won't.
Right.
The universe is so rich with phenomena. Can almost count. If you think of it, it's out there.
Something's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, you obviously aren't going to be able to watch this mechanism. Probably takes millions or trillions of years, but you could see each stage of it by looking around.
Well, do you worry? I know you said it's in a benign orbit. Do you worry about it not being serviced, that it won't last?
Well, that's definitely a concern. If something goes wrong, it goes wrong. So we had to be extremely careful in making it. And although, you know, for example, one thing that sort of went wrong was that when they first launched it, they began to see noise that they didn't know where it was coming from. It turned out that the mirrors would also reflect protons. And so when it came through the radiation belts, it was damaging the detector.
Ooh.
And everybody was in a panic state at that point. But then they thought about it. They did some tests in the laboratory. They keep a mock-up of the very same thing. They said, well, we just shut the detector. Not the telescope, but we close off the detector when we go through the radiation belts, and we open it up again. Mm-hmm. Problem solved, really.
How long did it take to design the Chandra? Was it a decade-long process?
Yeah, it was a decade-long. I mean, the original idea was broached in the late 60s with a very detailed thing. The funding wasn't there, and in a sense, it's maybe good because the technology has improved. And it really got going in the late 80s. They started really fabricating it and testing it. They had to do test things because there was still a lot of skepticism that you could build a telescope that would reflect X-rays and focus them as well as they claimed Chandra would. So they did the tests, passed the test. They says, all right, you got the go-ahead. And so it was launched in 1999.
And it's been up there ever since, transmitting and doing its job.
Yeah,
and
very
you said maybe another 5 years?
Maybe more.
Yeah. Let's keep it going. The smoothest mirror ever made. Yeah. Really amazing technology and just amazing images. And you can read it all in the book. Just came out from Smithsonian Books. It's Chandra's Cosmos. And our guest has been its author, Wallace Tucker, who's an astrophysicist and the author. And boy, it's really a great book because it's loaded with illustrations. Some are artist's conceptions and some are just recolored images directly from Chandra, which is, it's pretty amazing when you see these images. You're looking at the creation of the universe, the result of the creation of the universe, distant bodies, all sorts of things. Was it the big, the beautiful, and the ugly?
No,
bad.
Yeah.
The bad.
the big black hole that suck beautiful. Everything in. Yeah,
there's no ugly here. Right. Wallace, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the book. I encourage everybody to take a look. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to make pancakes. We're also going to talk about photography. But first, here's Father Robert Ballasair, who has taught us. Actually, should we see what the pancake pot's doing before we do that? What are you cooking? What are you cooking, Colleen? Are you cooking? Can you cook a black hole for me? Oh, look at that. It's our logo in a pancake.
What's the logo stand for?
It used to be a NAND gate. Then we turned it on its side and put an eye and gave it legs. And now it's just kind of a thing. It's the twit bug, we call it. Father Robert took a Raspberry Pi and created a Tor exit node. Or is it an entry node? It's a router. Watch.
Recently, the rules on internet privacy have changed, with ISPs now allowed to sell your internet fingerprints to third parties without your consent. Now, you could get angry, you could get political, or you could do something about it. Specifically, if you've got $40, you can create a device to help take your privacy back. At issue is the fact that your favorite websites probably use HTTPS to encrypt the data in transit. But while most of the data coming out of your client is encrypted, not all of it is. If you were to put a tap and Wireshark between your computer and the internet, you'd see everything that your ISP sees when you visit a site. And while most data streams have in-transit encryption, your DNS requests are most likely not encrypted. That means your ISP can see where you've been, what you visit the most, the types of information you search for, and pretty much everything. But we can stop that by using a low-priced Raspberry 3 to encrypt and anonymize our digital footprints using Tor, the Onion router, more than 7,000 volunteer nodes that relay encrypted data back and forth across the planet to anonymize location and usage information. We're using a Raspberry 3 because it's got the most power and because it has built-in Wi-Fi, so you don't have to add a dongle to make it work. We started with a fresh installation of the latest Raspbian OS and turned our Raspberry into a wireless access point by running a Git script created by Harry Allerston. This allowed us to create a Wi-Fi hotspot to which we can connect our phones, laptops, and anything else that needs to be on the internet. However, while that connects devices to the net, the traffic isn't yet running through Tor. For that, we needed to run the command sudo apt-get install Tor. And yes, I say sudo and not sudo. After a few commands to modify the config file, reset the IP tables, and set permissions on the log files, Tor is ready to run. After a quick reboot, we checked our tap traffic once again, and though we can see the traffic, it's all encrypted. The big test was to filter out everything but DNS, and with Tor, all traffic, including DNS, becomes unintelligible to our ISP. This is a fantastic device and a fun weekend project, but it's not a magic bullet. In fact, nothing in security is. You still have to do the things that you need to do in order to maintain your anonymity on the net. That means turning off scripts. It means making sure that your cookies aren't being handed out. It means making sure that your browser and your client isn't doing anything to identify you on the other side of the tunnel. Because if you do that, then you've just undone all the anonymity and all the protection that Tor can afford you. The other thing to remember about using Tor is that it's slow. You're bouncing from node to node to node, and it's a shared resource. That means don't even think about streaming video. And it also means that if you're going to be using a client that's going to be connecting to a server, say Amazon, that's going to identify you on the other side, that's probably not the best use of Tor. But if you're looking for a way to not be the lowest hanging fruit on the security tree, a Tor Pi might be just the thing for your weekend project. For the full step-by-step process of making a Tor Pi, be sure to watch Know How episode 301 at twit.tv/KH. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, geeking out for Twit TV.
That was geeky. That was geeky. Thank you, Father Robert. All right, we're going to switch gears a little bit. Actually, not, because Chandra is just a big kind of X-ray camera in the sky, right?
Yep.
We're going to come down to visible light, and maybe not quite so far away. Bill Wadman is here. He is a professional photographer specializing in commercial and editorial work, portraiture particularly.
Yep.
And you wowed me because you sent me an email saying, I've done these headshots for some of the people you know, like Andy Iannacco.
Yeah.
And in fact, can we show some of his headshots again? Because there's just really beautiful
stuff.
Yeah,
I know a lot
stuff.
Of people that you guys know and work with.
Yeah.
There's Neil Gaiman there in the green sitting on the chair.
I love
chairs.
That.
Yeah, he was a handful. Yeah. So I
bet he was. Baratunde?
Yep, Baratunde is in there.
Baratunde, you have some of the people we've worked with.
Buzz Aldrin there. Yep.
Buzz Aldrin, wow.
Yeah. It's funny, that part of the thing that I like about doing portrait photography is just meeting the people. There's Ray Kurzweil there.
Oh, nice. So you're a geek, obviously.
Yes, I'm a geek, a long-time geek, yeah.
Yeah, really.
And part of the great thing about it is that I get to spend 5, 10, 20, 30, sometimes an hour with these people that
have been heroes of mine for many years, right? You know, I'm doing it for work, but I get to spend time with them. And in some ways, the final photo ends up being an artifact of the experience of hanging out with them.
So what you like, and this is, I think this is the best photographers I know, this is true, you like people.
Yeah.
And the camera is just a device.
Yeah, absolutely.
To get to talk to it.
It's always funny to me that the portrait photographers who aren't good at talking to people or aren't good at interacting with people, and they exist. And I don't know how they get their job done because, I mean, it's psychology as much as it is anything, right? Yeah.
That is fantastic.
That, by the way, is a seriously massive composite. He was actually sitting on my table. The bottom of the stage is actually the back of a bench in a subway station.
No.
The Dave Hill I created an illustrator.
You've ruined
the curtains.
This picture.
Sorry.
For me.
Sorry.
I thought he was on stage. That's hysterical.
Yeah. But that kind of stuff happens too, right? Where it's a creative thing. You're right. Starting from an idea. You know, a couple hours ago we shot a picture of you, which we don't have yet. This woman was an Olympic gold medalist in judo. There's Kayla Harrison. She won again in.
Though, you make a good point because the best portraiture draws the person. There's Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah.
Draws the person's personality out. You get a sense of who they are, and that means you have to have a relationship.
Absolutely, and it's funny because like sometimes it takes time, right? Depending on the person, some people are very stiff when you first get in the room, and it takes a little time to sort of wear them down. So they almost
you had me under the desk right away.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, talking to them and getting them to feel comfortable is a big part of it.
Right.
And so that, as I said, it's a psychological game in some ways.
I couldn't help but notice the camera that you brought. a lot of people in your business will use DSLRs.
Sure.
Canon 5D Mark IV.
I have. I was a Canon guy for many years.
Right.
Last year I switched up to medium format. So this is a Pentax 645Z.
That's a much bigger sensor, right?
This is a sensor. It's about twice the size of what's in a full-frame SLR. It's not quite as big as a piece of 645 film, which is, you know.
Right.
But
it's
square. It's actually not square. This one is 4:3 ratio.
Okay.
So it is more rectangular or more closer to square
than a traditional
full-frame. You know, 35 millimeter is 2:3 ratio.
Right.
So
right.
It changes the way you compose stuff and that kind of thing. It also has massive amounts of information, right? This is a 51 megapixel camera.
Wow.
It's got tons of dynamic range.
That's the thing that's interesting about these cameras, the dynamic range. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, when you're taking pictures of any particular scene, you're going to have to deal with the fact that there's bright parts, there's, you know, white, the sky, or what have you. And then there's shadows. And in cameras, you can expose for either the shadows or the light or that kind of thing. The big trick is trying to get it so that you get the whole range of brightnesses into a single image. So certain sensors are better at that than others. Larger sensors, as in this camera, or newer sensors. These things get better over time the same way microchips, right?
Sure.
As CPUs get better. But ultimately, physics is the limiting factor, right? So we go bigger. We have bigger photo sites that can collect more photons, and that gives you an advantage. So that's one of the advantages of going to medium format over, say, full frame or crop sensor or, for you know, 4:3 center.
Lift that camera up, Megan. See if it's appropriate for.
Yeah.
For
it's big.
It's nice.
And this is the lightest, smallest lens that I could have on this.
Wow.
I mean, the thing is that everything in photography is a trade-off, right? I get exceptional quality, but as we were saying when we were in your office taking pictures, you know, you were saying, I thought about doing it, but people said, your technique has to be perfect in order to get the most out of it.
This is why I didn't get a medium format camera. That and the fact that it's a $9,000 camera.
Yeah.
But I've bought expensive cameras before.
You have more than $9,000 worth of cameras.
I am one of those people who foolishly thinks a better camera will make me a better photographer.
Right.
You'd think I'd have learned by now.
Yeah.
But somebody told me, probably Trey Ratcliffe, don't get a medium format because your technique has to be perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any defect, any shake, any movement will be seen.
Yes, right. Of course, there's so much information in there that shrink it down and it still looks just as good as your smaller thing.
Yeah.
But if you want to get the most out of it, absolutely. I mean, you got to use strobes or you got to use a tripod. You got to be critical focus, this kind of thing. And the larger the sensor, the shorter the depth of field, right? So like less stuff's in focus. This lens wide open on your eyeballs, your eyelashes are out of focus, right? It's like, you know, so this is a problem. For
so let's
a
talk
lot of people.
About portrait.
Let's
start with not necessarily a camera like this, but an interchangeable lens camera. What focal length is good? And now you've raised an interesting issue with aperture.
Sure.
Sometimes when Apple's portrait mode on its iPhone, the whole thing that made it portrait mode is the background's out of focus. That means a shallow depth of field.
And what they're doing is they're just trying to figure out where the person is, and they're blurring the background,
But a lot of times when you see a portrait and you say, that looks pro, what you're really saying is, well, the person's in focus and the background's out of focus.
Yeah. Or at least that's the shorthand version of what makes a good portrait
in
the world.
It looks like a pro. It looks professional to the average eye when you look at it on your phone.
A wide open aperture.
Yes, or a fast lens, as we call it in the business, right? And using that fast lens as close to wide as possible. You have all the same problems of focus that we were just talking about. A lot of people talk about the idea of a portrait lens, a longer lens, like an 85 or a 120, because it flattens perspective a little bit. So if somebody's got a little big nose or that kind of thing,
Wide angle, everybody's noses look big. If camera phones are wide angle, you get big noses.
Right.
Yeah. Right. See? I've been trying to explain that to you.
Right.
Megan and I have the biggest schnozzes on TV.
Which is the problem that a lot of people have with taking portraits with phones, is that you generally have to get pretty close up. Which is the new feature, it's like a 50mm lens equivalent in the new iPhones. The thing about it is that I personally, as a portrait photographer, have been doing this for going on 12, 15 years. I don't use a lot of portrait lenses. I don't use a lot of long lenses. I'll use wider lenses and just get more of the scene in the shot.
Okay.
Right? So I'm not shooting up close on anything. I could shoot up close on this, my friend Bun eating noodles. He's an executive chef at a restaurant.
But the story going on around
is the environment around them, right?
Yeah.
Environmental portraiture to me is more, it's more about the space around them than it is even the person in the space.
I love that. Look, it's a mermaid.
That wasn't, no digital effects were.
No, actually, she's a mermaid. It's true. And that's her real hair. But a lot of people think, portrait, it's going to be a tight headshot. And that's fine. These but to me, so it, you get something a lot more interesting if you back up. So that's like the equivalent of a 35mm on a full frame sensor, that shot.
Do you do a lot of post-production, a lot of Lightroom Photoshop?
I am a big Photoshop guy, almost anything I do touches Photoshop at some point. I rarely, if ever, finish stuff in Lightroom, or I use Capture One with the new camera.
Love this.
But for example,
do you make the color pop?
Yeah, a little bit. But even that shot was a flash bounced off the ceiling.
Wow.
That's all the lighting in that shot. It's not a big giant softbox. It's nothing fancy. Sometimes you could do a lot with a little, you know? And I mean, the trick with and I actually just grew a tree in this guy's house for this shot.
I want that house. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's a nice place in my neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, all sorts of things happen.
Yes. Yeah.
The tree grows in Brooklyn.
Do you ever shoot in film?
I do. I 35mm film, medium format, large format film. The thing is that for commercial work, they need it yesterday, right? Or they need it today. It used to be that you could take your slides down and an hour later go pick them up because, especially in, say, New York or L.A., that was the industry, right? Go shoot, run it off, it comes back after lunch. Nowadays, it's a day or 2 days to get stuff filmed, and you don't have time, and then you have to scan. And honestly, there was a point at which the quality of film, both the dynamic range and the color and the resolution, were so much better for film. This camera, you would need, honestly, a 4x5 view camera to get the level that I'm getting out of this thing.
51 megapixels. You said what the dynamic range is on
this? They say 14 and a half stops, something like that, right?
That's more than the eye. I mean, that's remarkable, right?
Which is great when you take these files into, say, Capture One or Lightroom, it's silly putty, right? I mean, you're pulling stuff out of where it's completely black, you're pulling it up, where it's, the highlights, you're pulling it back. But again, the right tool for the right job. I don't carry this camera around all day. It weighs 6 pounds, 8 pounds,
You got an iPhone?
I have a phone. It's this or this. These are my two cameras, right?
No point and shoot. You go straight
to the
iPhone.
Between. I've bought them and then I use them and then I end up saying, you know what? I don't use it enough, so I sell it.
Give us some tips for getting better iPhone portraits.
Well, iPhone portraits, I would say keep it simple, right? Bring somebody next to a window. It's all about the lighting, trying to get nice, soft lighting.
Single point lighting from the side.
Exactly.
It really looks nice.
Right. Yeah. It worked for the Masters. It's going to work for you.
Right.
Interestingly enough, a lot of people say, you're going to have to fill a little bit from the other side. A lot of people use reflectors and all this kind of stuff. You can get a piece of whiteboard from the hobby store. Right. Or even as a friend of mine went and shot some CEO a few years ago, and he came in and he didn't have anything with him, guy held up a newspaper on the other side. it's white enough, right? It's enough to just bounce stuff in there.
Right.
But really, great portraits are about trying to get the person comfortable. So, that's step number one. If you get that, some nice soft lighting, getting the color right, you're 90% of the way there.
Yeah. Bill Wadman, where can we see more of your work?
You can go to BillWadman.com. You can follow me Instagram and Twitter at Bill Wadman. I'm doing a daily portrait project right now.
Oh, neat. There's Joko. I love Jonathan Colton.
At Wadman365, I'm doing a daily portrait, which is why I shot you today.
Am I one of your days?
You will be today's portrait, Wadman365 on Instagram. And I do a couple podcasts on taking pictures on 5x5.
Nice.
On Dan Benjamin's network. I've been doing for 5 years with my friend Jeffrey. Jeffrey Sidoris. And I do one called Ask Bill and Dan. It's sort of like your tech guy podcast, but for photo stuff.
Awesome.
So Ask Bill and Dan. So check those out.
That's great.
All right.
Great network. Well, it's very nice to meet you, Bill. Thank
pleasure.
You. And I'll be following your Instagram.
Okay.
What is it again?
Wadman365.
W-A-D-M-A-N 365.
That's it.
So I can see myself.
There it is.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bill. You want to join us for some pancakes?
Absolutely.
It's pancake time. Come on, everybody. Colleen's been working her tail off. Yep. Look at all these pancakes you made. Look, there's the Twit pancake. This is fun because this is me. That's supposed to be me. That is as good a portrait as Bill took. Not. You can kind of see some features in there, though. You got, you know, there's some nose and mouth. I want to eat this so bad. I really do. So this is the Pancake Bot. And joining us right now, the creator of the Pancake Bot, Miguel Valenzuela. He's on Skype. He lives just out of Oslo in Norway. Hi, Miguel.
How you doing? Thanks for having me on the show today.
This is a very professional product right now. At this point, we're talking like serious stuff. But I understand your prototype was not quite so elaborate.
Well, it was elaborate to me and my kids, actually. But the prototype was originally made out of Legos.
What?
99% Legos and 1% ketchup bottles.
And this is your daughter? You built this because she
daughter,
said,
Maya.
Daddy, build a pancake bot with Lego.
Actually, that was Maya. She was 1.5. Lily, who talked at the time, was 3.5.
Oh, okay.
She's the one who inspired the whole thing. But yeah, that's the first version, or actually iteration number 13 right there after 6 months of and about 20 liters of pancake batter.
Who ate all the pancakes you made on your bot?
I did. And my daughters and my wife.
And did you learn a lot about the ins and outs of pancake making?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's so many variables with pancake batter and cooking. There's viscosity and the amount of time it takes. Normal pancake artists, when they draw with pancake batter, they use time and heat to be able to create contrast because of the color changes with the caramelization.
So the longer
of the sugar.
It cooks, the darker it's going to be. So you can actually get shading in. Look, this is we're building. What is this? The skyline? That's so awesome. Now, where
nice.
Do you get where do we get the patterns from? How does this work? Do we do this from a phone? Well,
currently right now you can take a picture and actually with the software that we just put out there and actually do an auto trace on it. So
I've got an idea for your next Instagram. Wadman Pancake 365.
Exactly.
This is
and
awesome.
Then on pancakebot.com we have a user group or a group for PancakeBot users. They can go online and they can upload their pre-made designs and share them with the community, and they can share recipes and troubleshooting and, you know, whatever it is that they have, hints and tips. You know, so there's a lot of things that you can share with fellow people on PancakeBot. The cool thing is it's not just for pancakes, though. Once you start switching out other things with, you know, instead of pancake batter, whether it's different types of you can do anything with you know, like has a batter consistency you can use in the pancake bot, and you can start doing, you know, a lot of different things with it. So it's pretty fun.
Like ketchup? Could you use this to like put ketchup on a sandwich or something?
Yeah, and that's you can do it with ketchup. I've done like avocado puree with sour cream in there, and we would actually get a plate and we would put it down and we decorate the plate, so that way we wanted to create like a little plate with designs on it. We'd pop a big burrito on there and serve it to friends and stuff, and then you can put colored syrup or whatever on top of the pancake bot after you make the pancake, and so there's a lot of cool things you can do with it.
So the pancake bot itself is exciting enough, but this also can teach people engineering, coding. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, well, the cool thing about this is that when we're working, the company that we put this together with is Storebound. They're their manufacturer. And I told them that if we were going to be working together, we really needed to make this as open as possible. And of course, you know, from a manufacturing standpoint, it's hard for people to get injection molding plans out there. So we want to make sure at least the hardware and the software is open. So the software is open source, written JavaScript by James Todd. He's Maker out based out of Sacramento. And then the machine actually is has open source components and stuff like that. And it just uses G-code too. So that way you don't have to have a proprietary piece of software or files to read for it. So you can go in there and code your own G-code. You can create your own algorithms with Python to create spirals or fractals or whatever you want. And then if you want to hack it, there is a place in Canada actually that they took the PancakeBot and they put a Hall effect sensor on it, and they were using it to scan pieces of metal pipe to be able to measure the density with the magnetic flux changes. So it's a simple CNC machine that you can use, and you hack it for whatever you want to do and still make pancakes. So
I can't tell you how mesmerizing it is to watch this thing print this stuff. It's really, this is watching the pancakes being made, man. This is a new thing for me. Is this pretty much like a 3D plotter? Is that kind of the same idea?
It kind of is, because, I mean, you're basically putting layers down. There is no Z-axis for it, except for the layers that you can put on there. Right. But the cool thing is that you can we're developing a curriculum that people are going to be able to – students are going to be able to use in different schools for different levels, so that way they can learn about programming and mechanical engineering and also electrical engineering and making pancakes. And there's a company in San Diego that actually copied or trademarked Pancakeology. And it's a maker space in San Diego there, and it's our maker place. And so we're going to work with them to use Pancakeology, the science of pancakes, to teach kids about, you know, the different recipes that you can have. And the cool thing, another cool thing, is that you have a 3D print or a print that's, you know, that prints out in 5 minutes or something like that. You get to see your results, and you get to eat them too.
Bill, get your camera and take a portrait of Megan with her screensavers on a tray. That's the best picture.
That looks so great.
That is so awesome. That is so awesome.
You know, this week Google announced that they've developed AI that can sketch like a human being. So I think that might be the next step, that you get, you know, some AI in here and just
AI
see what happens.
AI pancake bot. That's
just see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, hold on a second. Hey, pancake bot, draw dinosaur pancake.
Oh, man. Can it do
is
that?
Is it moving?
No.
You guys got version 2.0. Sorry.
Oh, no.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. You guys need the AI version for that.
Oh, I do that.
Operated
that's awesome.
Pancakes.
Yeah. Picked a bad day to skip lunch. I got to tell you, I'm dying here. This looks so good. We are just using traditional Krusty's pancake mix here. This isn't anything fancy. Wait a minute. Was this Colleen's idea to make this one, Jerry? That is funny.
Oh, that's the thumbs up. The other one is.
Yeah, the other one's the I like.
Or it
I
could
like
be a it. Thumbs down if need be.
It took them a little. They've been making pancakes all week here, which, by the way, has made the studio smell phenomenal. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. We were in 2014. We got to go to the White House Maker Fair and make pancakes at the White House.
For President Obama.
Oh, yeah.
Did you?
We were smelling. The whole house, the White House, smelled like pancakes.
As it should.
Did you use whole wheat flour for Michelle?
We did whatever we were supposed to do. So I mean,
the Secret Service instructed you.
Secret Service,
exactly.
So classified information on that. But
should I help you here?
It's a versatile machine that, you know, if you want to use it for cafes or if you want to use it for, you know, hotels or something to that effect, and anywhere that you want to really create an experience for people, you can use the pancake bot there. And we have people using it for their after-school programs, for the Scouts, for different things, to fundraisers. There's a professor from Minnesota that created tessellation, an extension for his tessellation software. So we created tessellation pancakes, actually, that are MC Escher inspired.
Look at
and,
that. This
yeah,
is so cool.
Fractals, too.
How much is the pancake bot?
It retails for $299,
well,
and if you're an educator, if you're an educator or a school, we do have an education discount for you. And we're always working on videos, to how-to videos and different ideas and that kind of thing. And I'm always busting out pancakes for the kids over here at my daughter's school.
I bet. And, you know, unlike an inkjet printer, the consumables, and I mean consumables for this, are very inexpensive. And you can eat them later.
Exactly. You can eat your mistakes, too.
Yeah, it's just pancake batter. Nothing special. Nope. You don't have to buy special pancake bot pancake batter or anything like that. Wow.
No, and you can make your own pancake batter from scratch. We got a great recipe in there. And
we were lazy. We used a mix, yeah.
Oh, okay. Hey, no problem. No problem.
So, Miguel, that looks great, this is though. So cool. Impressed. I know. Look at that. That's the skyline of New York City. See the Statue of Liberty right there? You could just eat her torch.
Take
the torch right off. Really neat. Miguel, it was great to talk to you. I've been, you know, watching some of, I think, I like people I follow on Instagram have bought these. I'm sure Justine has one. And it's just, it's really fun. And now to see it actually at work. And I love this. I think we need to buy this so we can have. What are you doing now? Are you spelling the new screensavers?
I'm trying, yeah.
That's awesome. Somebody said, what, you could do chocolate if you had like a cold, instead of a hot plate, you had a cold plate, you could make chocolate.
Yeah, I've experimented with chocolate, and you can get that warm chocolate that you put in the microwave or something like that, or put it in hot water, and you can get a pretty good burst out of there. It cools down pretty quickly, but you can do some chocolate in there. And like I said, we've done like if you're a cook or a chef at a restaurant, you can use it to decorate the plate and put food on top of that. So imagine if you're eating like sushi and you want to put down like a nice wasabi fractal or something like that. You could do a little wasabi puree or something and lay it down in a pattern or whatever. So there's so many things that you can do with it, not just, you know, making pancakes. And this is kind of like it's really the first consumer food printer out there.
Yes.
And, it's fun. So we hope it's really a success.
I think you're on the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, my God, you're going to be the pancake bot mogul here.
Yeah. What ideas do your daughters have next?
Yeah.
Oh, those are all top secret. Okay. Make sure that they write them all in books. But, you know, actually, my daughters actually are really want to do something, you know, to help a lot of the kids out there and stuff, that whether they have financial problems or whether they're in different countries with different economic or social problems. My kids have traveled around with me with the pancake bot, you know, all over the world. And so they see a lot of these things happening. They see the news and they're, Dad, what can we do with pancake bot? Or what can I do to invent to help these kids out? So they really have their, that's a nice pancake there. So
can I eat my own head? Is that allowed? I don't know.
It's amazing that you're giving discounts to schools. I mean, that's a great way to teach STEM. I mean, you tell them they're already helping.
Yeah.
Well, I totally love the whole STEAM concept of adding the art in there. And, you know, I would really like to kind of do like a Renaissance kid, because Renaissance people, they just kind of knew everything. They were like jacks of all trades. And if we just have Renaissance kids that can like do everything, love science, that. Technology, engineer, art, math, cooking, whatever it is, it'd be so much fun. But it's a great product, so I'm really happy that we've gone this far. And Storebound, our manufacturer, has been fantastic. I work with Evan Dash there, the CEO, and Slim Garanza from project manager, and these guys have been doing a fantastic job with helping us get this thing to market. So it's great.
Is it pancakebot.com?
Yes, sir. Pancakebot.com.
I love it. I think it's so amazing.
It makes me shout PancakeBot, PancakeBot.
PancakeBot!
Shouting it all week in joy.
Well, I gotta say that there's a you've probably heard of Evil Mad Scientists. They're these this team, husband and wife team. They're based out of Sunnyvale. They came up with the EggBot. And they were really my inspiration for calling it a pancake bot. So they're professional makers, and they're wonderful people. And so they're there you go. So they're
just in time for
get a shout out to
actually,
them for inspiring me to be able to do this thing. Yes. So and a shout out to the maker community and the maker fair, that these kind of things really inspire us to get things out there and pursue, you know, these kind of things. So
I agree.
It's really neat.
Well, so nice to meet you, Miguel. Congratulations on your success. This is a wonderful product. Miguel Valenzuela, pancakebot.com. Let's eat!
Thank you very much, and have a wonderful day there. And
thank you,
Mikhail. See you later.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye. I think we even have Screensavers maple syrup for those who require a little bit. The mailbag coming up next. First, Jason Howell shows us how YouTube TV works on Android.
If you find yourself straying from the clutches of traditional satellite and cable television, then you might have noticed in the past that the options for over-the-top video content aren't quite as comparable. At least, that's been true for years until recently. Now we have, well, you know, Hulu, Sling TV, and Sony's PlayStation View, just to name a few, all bringing their own assortment of networks into the digital realm. For a fee, of course. Google just got into that game with the release of YouTube TV. And I have to say, prior to this, I was a PlayStation View devotee. I found my new jam here. The big four networks are represented, plus a nice collection of cable networks to fill it all in, including a healthy supply of sports content, if that's your thing, that can be customized down to the teams that you care about. YouTube TV doesn't have an app for your set-top box. Not yet, anyways. It's all about mobile and desktop. This is the app running on my Google Pixel smartphone. One thing I love about the YouTube TV interface is that any of these carousels and thumbnails for a particular network shows what's actually playing in real time as you navigate through. As I swipe through the popular live TV carousel here, all of those channels are streaming to that little thumbnail for each one in real time. That makes it easier to make my choice of what I want to watch. The home screen contains all sorts of popular shows, as you can see, YouTube Red content, which is included here even without a separate Red subscription, movies, sports, and a whole lot more. Swiping left brings me to Live, which is merely a vertical list of all channels represented in YouTube TV. But again, that live video is streamed as I browse, making for the perfect channel surfing experience. Tapping into a show actually brings it up to the top of the screen with related episodes and content down below it. YouTube TV includes unlimited cloud DVR. So while I'm here, I can just tap that plus icon, and that's going to add it to my DVR list. And going forward, all episodes for that show will be saved for me to watch whenever I want to. Those saved programs can be found in the library index by swiping all the way to the right in the interface. If you want to watch any of this content on your big screen at home, you're going to need a cast-enabled TV set or Chromecast to send it over to. YouTube TV is competitively priced at $35 per month. They're all kind of around that range right now, with the first month free to try it out. If you happen to buy your second month up front when you sign up, Google throws in a Chromecast for free, which is a very nice bonus. Find YouTube TV on Android, iOS, and in the browser on your desktop. And you can find me, Jason Howell, all over the Twit Network. Tech News Today, of course, with Megan Maroney, as well as All About Android.
Very nice. Thank you, Jason.
I like the YouTube TV. I've been using it on my
iPad.
You're
a cord cutter.
I'm a cord cutter, and I have an Android TV. No, gasp. But and I said I was going to do a tip on how to do it, and you were like, it's very easy. And you're right. It's just one button. One button.
Because an Android TV is a Chromecast.
Yeah, it's a Chromecast cast in, and you just on the iPad to the Android TV. Everyone's getting along. It's lovely.
That's the only drawback on YouTube TV. I was hoping there'd be an Android TV app or a Roku app or something like that. You have to use it on your iOS device or your Android device and Chromecast it to your TV. Mm-hmm. But that gives you a nice remote control, you know, and I mean, it works pretty well. Mm-hmm. For $35, it's definitely. And the thing is, I feel like our kids, they grew up watching YouTube. Mm-hmm. They're going to be very comfortable with this.
Right. That's how they learn everything, how to drive, et cetera. But I'm just doing the free month. I don't think I'm going to sign up because there's mostly garbage on regular TV. I mean.
Actually, you didn't miss anything this whole time. Yeah. No. You're realizing that now, aren't you?
I am. It's all podcasts all the time. That's all you need.
So thank you for coming in. We actually called Megan at the last minute. We paged her. And fortunately, we've been making her wear a beeper, and it's paid off. First time in 5 years. She came in at the last minute. So thank you. Apologize to your husband. I know. I apologize to your husband. I know you two were planning on furniture shopping today.
Yeah, he's very upset that he doesn't get to go furniture shopping.
It's mailbag time, and here we go. We're going to do it over here because the pancake pot is taking up all the room. Oh, look, my 1040 EZ. Uh-huh. Oh, wait a minute. This just came in over the transom. I should do like Rachel Maddow and say, coming up later.
just one page.
You get to Tuesday because this is April 15th.
Yes.
But you get till Tuesday because it's a Saturday. Have you done your taxes already?
I have. I just did them yesterday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually did my mom's taxes for her because she's been paying somebody. I said, Mom, I could do that probably. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, it really has gotten very easy with TurboTax or whatever software you use. It's all online, file electronically. It only took me a little bit. It wasn't
yeah,
so bad.
Yeah, it's not so hard.
It's probably good for us at this point to do a public service announcement. I know you know this, but remember to tell your friends and family who are less tech aware, the IRS will never call you at home. They will never send you an email. This is, of course, scammer heaven for the next few days and maybe even the next few weeks. People trying to file on your behalf and take your tax refund, call you and say, I'm the IRS. Quick, you got to log in. Tell your family and friends, don't believe it. They will never call you, never email you. You always get a nice U.S. snail message. I'm going to read this one, and you can have that one.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. This has a very long email from a member of Congress attached to it. So Paul wrote to us. He said he wrote to his representative, Daryl Issa. He is for the California's 49th Congressional District. It's like San Diego, part of Orange County. And he said, I'm disappointed that you voted in favor of, rewinding those internet privacy rules that keep my internet service provider from spying on us without our permission. The congressman wrote back, and I thought, what the question, Paul's question was, can Daryl Issa's response to my email be correct, or is it smoke and mirrors? I want to know what you think. So here's what his congressman person said. Thank you for contacting me to express your concerns. I appreciate your views, and I hope to clear up any misinformation on this important issue. I share your concerns on supporting the safety and integrity of our personal information online. Oh, really? That's me, not him. In my time in Congress and as a technology entrepreneur, I've worked tirelessly on issues, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to skip his all the things he's done and go right to the paragraph that's relevant. The House of Representatives recently voted to repeal an Obama-era midnight regulation. There's some loaded words. Midnight regulation, Obama-era, requiring subscribers to opt in to allow service providers to collect data to use for targeted advertising or to improve their quality of service. He leaves out, by the way, an additional reason that ISPs may want to sell your information to third parties. Okay. This prompted misleading headlines you may have seen like, quote, how the Republicans sold your privacy to internet service providers. So let me be clear. This resolution has absolutely zero impact on anyone's privacy. Okay, so I can tell you right now that's not true. Internet service providers could do nothing today they could not do 3 months or even a year ago. Well, that's a little deceptive because that was before the Obama regulation was in place. So that's true. Even the Wall Street Journal, blah, blah, blah. He says this is what actually happened. In the waning months of the last administration, the FCC made an unprecedented power grab, unilaterally deciding to regulate the internet as a utility. This is separate, by the way, but that is true. And taking partial authority away from the Federal Trade Commission, which for years had been policing data and privacy practices. His point, I can go on, and we'll put this online somewhere. His point was that, Facebook, and you hear this a lot, Facebook and Google can spy on you, so it's not an even playing field. And unfortunately, the House of Representatives decided that instead of raising the requirements for Facebook and Google to protect your privacy, they lowered the requirements for internet service providers to protect your privacy. That's how you make a level playing field. Just forget privacy. He says, according to polls, 94% of consumers want privacy standards to apply equally across all companies and not just a select few. Yeah, we want privacy standards, not no privacy standards. The internet has become a fundamental part of our personal lives and our economy. We need to get the protections right. Well, we'll see. He does point out that the new Federal Communication Commission Chairman, Ajit Pai, put out a statement saying he wants to work on a comprehensive and consistent framework for digital privacy that assures all actors in the online space should be subject to the same rules. Good, as long as there are some rules. The problem is there are no rules right now. So, yes, it's smoke and mirrors, Paul, and you understand what he's saying is there should be no rules.
I'm not sure I agree with that. All right.
Yeah, I mean, you can opt out if you have Comcast. You can opt out.
Only
I watched,
because Comcast says you can. Right. They're not required to do that.
No. But I watched Jason Howell try to opt out. It was endless loops.
Yeah.
It was
they
like
really
45 minutes. You have to go through to each one and opt out. And Comcast doesn't really care. They don't care necessarily about selling your information to other advertising networks because they have their own advertising networks that they're going to use that information for.
We should also point out that, yes, Facebook and Google spy on you, but you don't have to use Facebook and Google. You do have to use the internet. That was another thing that the Republicans have recently, Jim Sensenbrenner, Republican congressman, said, well, you don't have to use the internet.
Yeah.
Nobody's making you use the internet. Okay.
That's not an okay thing to say.
Sorry, Jim. So Facebook and Google are in a different position. They're individual companies. You can use other companies if you want to protect your privacy. You're kind of stuck with your internet service provider, and most of us don't have much choice in internet service providers. So I don't think it's the same. And I also think they should maybe start thinking about how to protect our privacies with Facebook and Google. Instead of eliminating protections with our internet service.
Right. And I think, I mean, that he should talk to any public school because they are making you use the internet. Like, you cannot not have the internet as a child in a public school. So.
Yeah, I don't think it's an optional thing.
Okay. Here's another question. This comes from Sean. Sean asks, Leo, you said in a previous episode that you're starting to feel a little wary of LastPass, 1Password, etc. I am a hardcore Apple user. In fact, my whole life is in the hands of Apple's iCloud. Should that scare me? I've always been cautious when it comes to security, having 3-2-1 backups and using two-factor authentication. However, I allow Apple to generate and store all my passwords within Keychain since Mobile Safari does not allow LastPass or 1Password to autofill. Anyway, I stay up to date on my iPad Pro, MacBook Pro, and iPhone 7, so is storing all my generated passwords in Keychain safe?
Yes. We should, by the way, last week we had Steve Gibson on who said, don't worry, LastPass is safe. So I am continuing to use LastPass because I trust Steve. But no, Apple's keychain's done quite well. It generates good passwords. It stores them securely. The only reason I don't use it is I'm not. It only works for people entirely in the Apple Apple ecosystem. So if I use anything besides iPhones and Macs and iPads, it's not very useful to me. But if that's all you use, yeah, I think that's a very good choice. That's fine.
Does Keychain generate passwords?
It does.
What about Google's Keychain, which is not called Keychain, but it's called something else? It's just suddenly started popping up all
in
over the
Chrome, and in fact, all browsers do this. You can store your passwords. But I don't consider it all that secure for a couple of reasons. One, Chrome will sync your passwords to other Chrome instances. So that means it is going on Google's servers. And while you can provide a password, in fact, you have to provide a password if you do that, it's not clear if it's trust no one, if only you know the password, or if Google knows it as well. I suspect Google does know it. Also, if somebody can get on your computer, they can see all your passwords. The browser is not hiding those passwords, so you can actually open the browser settings on all browsers, look at passwords. You know, they have stars or dots, but you can show them and see all the passwords in the clear. So I think it's a little bit less than secure. I think it's probably better not to use your browser's password manager. I always turn that off. And it's okay to use Keychain as your password manager. That's safer. Actually, if you're only using Safari on the Mac, I'm pretty sure Safari stores its passwords in the Keychain as well, so that would be safe. But if you use Chrome or some other browser, stick with Keychain. It's fine. Now, you did mix two things up, and I just want to point this out. He says his whole life is in the hands of Apple's iCloud. iCloud is not the same as Keychain. Keychain is a local encryption service that you keep on your computer. Your keychains are backed up, but they're backed up encrypted. Other stuff that's stored on iCloud, like documents, are encrypted, but Apple has the key. So that's a case where Apple has and will and has had in the past and will in the future, I'm sure, if they get a subpoena from law enforcement, hand that stuff over. So your keychain's still safe because it's encrypted locally. I like the keychain. I think it's a good system. So yeah, you could trust the keychain. Not a bad idea. Thank you, Sean. We should talk more about that on iOS today. We're going to have fun on Monday.
We are. We have a group of students from Australia coming to visit us. They're on a STEM tour of all the most important places in the United States to go.
And they're coming
to
here?
Learn about technology.
Oh, they're coming for the pancakes. We know
they're
that.
Probably.
Yeah. Look, we have an Easter bunny. So we're going to do all Australian apps.
Yes. So we've got some, but if you have some suggestions, just email me at megan@twit.tv. Apps made by Australian developers. There are some good ones, but if
there
you have
really
one,
yeah.
Those Australians, they're busy and smart.
Well, you have till April 20th to vote for the Webbies. Don't forget, that's twit.to/Webbies2017. Be fun to win a Webby. And then I'll have to come up with my 5-word acceptance speech.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Something about Meghan Maroney, no doubt.
Yes.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. did you see the video those guys made? That silly video?
I had some promo ideas, too. I mean, the one where I would Moses, our security guard, and I would have triangulation in my iPhone, and it would be like a protest. I know you had that idea, but like you just hand it over.
Oh.
I think that would be really good.
And then he votes
idea.
For us?
Yeah.
All right.
Nothing like protests to really sell things.
Thanks to all of you for joining us again. Thanks to you for coming in on a short notice on your day off. We do triangulation. We do this new screensavers every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. You can watch live, be in our chat room at irc.twit.tv. You'll see all the good stuff that we edit out, like that really weird pancake. But we did cut that out. Right? But if you would like to see the packaged whole version at your leisure, you can always get on-demand versions of everything we do right here at twit.tv/NSS for this show, and also wherever you subscribe. Meghan Maroney will be back on Monday with TNT, 4 p.m. Pacific. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC, and of course, iOS Today earlier in the day. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a lot of fun. Thanks to all of you for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye! Have a pancake! Yum! Those are green pancakes. Those pancakes look green.